Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Let someone else fight over this long, blood-stained sand. That's President Trump talking about the U.S. withdrawal from northern Syria yesterday as he announced a permanent ceasefire agreement with Turkey. The deal concerns Syria, Turkey, Russia, Iran, and Kurdish groups around the region. It's all high stakes and really confusing. So here to help us break it all down is Stephen Kinzer. He's a senior fellow in international and public affairs at Brown University's Watson Institute of International and Public Affairs. Stephen, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Always good to be here.
So we really are trying to kind of do an explainer here. So first, maybe a simple question. Could you start by explaining who are the Kurds and why are we talking about them as separate from the countries in the region?
The Kurds are descendants of a group of ancient mountain tribes. The first reference we have to them goes all the way back 2,500 years when the Greek historian Xenophon found some of these tribes, and he wrote two things about them. He said they live in the mountains, they're fierce, and they do not obey the king. So that's actually still a pretty good description. Kurds now number well into the tens of millions, and they're spread out because of the vicissitudes of modern geography over a region that includes eastern Turkey, Syria, Iran, Iraq. And it wasn't until the 19th century, with the growth of ethnic nationalism, that these different tribes began to think of themselves all as Kurds or a Kurdish nation. But they certainly have developed that consciousness now and have become an important factor, even though they've never had their own nation state.
So a virtual nation made up of a diaspora, basically.
Yes, although a diaspora suggests to me people that have come from somewhere else. By the time the Turks, for example, arrived in what's now Turkey, the Kurds had been there for well over 1,000 years.
Okay, so how did the U.S. and Kurdish groups end up on the same side fighting ISIS in Syria?
When the United States decided that it wanted to get involved in the Syria civil war, we did something similar to what we did when we decided to invade Afghanistan. That is, not wanting to send our own troops into battle, we looked for some partner force or mercenary force, if you will. Most of the forces that we found were fanatic jihadists who hated the secular Assad government. And one of the worst outcomes of this war is that we have fed a lot of weapons and money into al-Qaeda and ISIS-related groups. But we also found another ally, which was the Kurds. So they have often been for rent to Americans and their interest in the United States. They've traditionally been pro-American. They are known as good fighters. And they, unlike our other allies in Syria, are secularists themselves. So they participated quite vigorously in a number of American campaigns in Syria, including the battle to take Raqqa. Why did they do that? Not only were they paid and sponsored by the U.S. government, but we offered them something extra without saying it explicitly. The Kurds in northern Syria dreamed of establishing their own little statelet or mini country right along the Turkish border there. This was probably never realistic. The population is far too small. It has no air force. It was never going to be able to establish itself as a real state. But it could remain viable as long as the United States was there.
Okay.
So the effective deal was, we'll fight for you if you preserve us here in our little statelet and don't leave, because without you, we can't survive.
Okay. Now, I do want to move on, but I need to go back, and because I imagine some of our listeners went, I'm sorry, what? Because did you say a minute ago that the U.S. wound up funneling arms and support to al-Qaeda and ISIS?
We did. Actually, our main cat's paws, our main supporters in Syria were groups that were jihadist. And the reason for this is very logical. We were trying to depose the secular government of Assad. And the people who hated Assad the most, not only in Syria, but people coming from all over the world, were Islamic extremists. They didn't want a secular regime in Syria. So when we were looking for partners to fight against Assad, we put aside the fact that these people were actually connected to al-Qaeda and other jihadist groups and thought, just like the German politicians thought in the 1930s, we'll help these people overthrow Assad, and then once they get in, we'll control them.
All right. So, given that background, move on to your reaction to the president's announcement yesterday of a permanent ceasefire agreement. What's your reaction?
The way this was done was obviously quite poorly planned and left terrible bad feelings, as well it should have. But for the Kurds, there was a logical plan B. Once the Americans were gone, their only logical ally left was Assad, the government, because those are the two principal anti-jihadists, the two principal secular forces in Syria. So the Kurds seek protection now from the Assad government, which, at the behest of the United States, they have been fighting up until now.
But is that, in your mind, a bad thing or a good thing?
I think it's a good thing. I think it's the best way out for the Kurds. Right now, with the Americans out, the only hope for the Kurds is to get some protection against an unbridled Turkish onslaught. Turkey's on the border. Turkey considers the Kurds enemies, and it was already starting to bomb them. As a result of this agreement, Kurds will move back from the border, and Turkey will stop its war against them.
It's a little counterintuitive because the Kurds were fighting against the regime. That's why we partnered with them. So why is there any reason to believe they would be protected by that regime now?
This is, of course, something that the Americans are warning the Kurds about even now. Don't ask for protection under Assad. But for the Kurds, it's the only other place to go.
What about Russia?
Russia will be a partner of Assad. So the Russians are actually some kind of a guarantor for the Kurds that they won't be repressed or crushed by Assad. However, if you spin this out in the future, the Kurds, now having been more or less rescued by the Russians in their deal with Assad and the Turks, could in the future become cat's paws for the Russians. The Russians could then be telling them, you owe us. And whenever Russia wants to stage some provocation against Turkey, they now have the Kurds on their side.
Okay, there's so much more to get into here. I'm torn between going back and picking up Turkey or staying with Russia for a minute. Let's stay with Russia for a minute, because one perception of this situation, now that Erdogan and Turkey have gone in and the U.S. has pulled out and Erdogan has made his own deal with Russia, is that what the United States essentially did was cede United States interests to Russia to favor Russian interests, whether intentionally or not. What do you say to that?
There's some truth to that, but it's not a bad thing. Actually, what the ultimate shape of the Syrian government turns out to be is not a major strategic interest to the United States.
Then why were we there?
We never should have been. We were always there illegally. There was never a resolution of the U.S. Congress or any international body like the United Nations allowing us to be there. The United States has been trying to overthrow the Assad family government in Syria intermittently for 50 years. And this is because Syria has never embraced the American project in the Middle East. They've always been in the resistance front. When the so-called Arab Spring broke out, we thought this is our chance now
Egypt,
to get rid of Assad.
I just want to explain what the Arab Spring is.
When demonstrations started propping up across the Arab world, we presumed that this would also mean it's a chance for us to finish our agenda in Syria. And therefore, we partnered with people who normally we would have considered enemies, because we thought it was a way to destroy the Assad regime, which has been a thorn in our side unnecessarily, from our perspective, for many years.
Okay, last question in the history lesson side, and then we're going to do some analysis of what's going on right now. Where does Turkey fit into this picture, especially Turkey's relationship with the Kurds?
Turkey has a very large Kurdish population. They have never gotten along well. The Turkish state has always considered Kurdish nationalism to be a threat. The state fears that Turkey could become the next Yugoslavia or next Soviet Union and split apart.
Well, there is the PKK, which is Kurdish associated inside Turkey, which both Turkey and the U.S. recognize as a terrorist organization, correct?
That's true. And the PKK is also embraced by large numbers of Kurds inside of Turkey as their only representative, because legal Kurdish identity or cultural organizations don't exist. So therefore, the PKK has more or less a monopoly on large amounts of Turkish sympathies, Kurdish sympathies in Turkey. So because the Turkish state considers Kurdish authority and power to be a threat, it not only has repressed Kurdish mayors and Kurdish political movements inside its own country, It wants to be sure that there is no Kurdish presence inside Syria along the Turkish border. This has, I think, two benefits for President Erdogan at this moment. Number one, it gives him a step in his dream of reestablishing some kind of larger Turkey or Ottoman authority in a region where the countries that used to dominate, like Egypt and Iran and Iraq, no longer have any political power. And it also helps Erdogan at home. It's always good in Turkey when there's an economic or political uncertainty to gin up the anti-Kurdish nationalist feeling. And this has already had a positive effect. It helps Erdogan at home while it feeds his fantasies of Ottoman power abroad.
Okay, so now we're going to move to some of the analysis of what's happening right now. And I want to do this kind of rapid fire. All right, so question number one, regardless of whether you agree with the United States pulling out of Syria, are the criticisms that it destabilizes our relationships with other countries because it looks like we will turn and betray, are those fair and is that risky for the U.S.?
Those are fair. It certainly was a betrayal, but we have been betraying the Kurds over history. You can write a book about it, and in fact, people have. The idea that the U.S. is always a steadfast and faithful ally was never really justified. And if anyone should know this, it's the Kurds, who have been repeatedly betrayed after following U.S. promises time and again.
So what about those who are crying foul and saying other allies now won't trust us? I think you're saying other allies never should have trusted us. Is that really what you're saying?
I think that when you get into treaty allies with whom we have permanent alliances, yes, I think there is a measure of trust demanded. But when it comes to these alliances out in other parts of the world, we should never think that the militias that we ally with don't have their own interests. And we have our own interests. Ultimately, in the end, those interests are going to separate. And it's naive for anybody to believe that a country like the United States will have permanent allies rather than just permanent interests.
Okay, so let's put another piece of the puzzle in place. The other country from that general region that we've been hearing a lot about is Ukraine. Does it fit into this picture? And if so, how?
I think it's distantly related, and I think the relation would have to be through Russia. Russia is insisting that it has a right to help shape geopolitical events in its neighborhood. And actually, Ukraine will always be closer to Russia than it is to us, and so will Syria. So I think we need to step back from this idea that everything that's geopolitically good for Russia is bad for us. Everything that's good for Assad is bad for us. This isn't true. In fact, the greatest benefit for the United States, the best policy for us in the long run in Syria to tamp down extremism in that region would be to promote unification of Syria under the present government. We've never been able to do that because we want to overthrow the present government. But it's now time for us to swallow and realize that the Kurds are doing something that can promote stability, which is that ultimate goal of unifying Syria under the authority of the central government.
Okay, so I have to acknowledge that there are some listeners whose hair you're curling now with some of what you're saying, but it's helpful to get a perspective on this and get it combed out. There's one other strategic issue I want to bring in. Here is a quick cut of something the president said yesterday while discussing the agreement.
We've secured the oil, and therefore a small number of U.S. troops will remain in the area where they have the oil. And we're going to be protecting it, and we'll be deciding what we're going to do with it in the future.
It is not typical to hear us so openly talking about financial and other kinds of economic and strategic interests when discussing policy in the Middle East. What do you make of the very overt way the president is choosing to talk about the role of oil in this agreement and in this region?
I like it way better than when Donald Rumsfeld said, quote, about the Iraq War, "This war has nothing to do with oil, literally nothing to do with oil." I like Trump's formulation better.
Why?
Because it's more honest. Nobody, no great power has ever made policies toward the Middle East in the 20th or 21st century that are not related to oil. So let's put it right out there.
Okay, so that then makes me want to ask from my old poli-sci classes, right? Are we, okay, backtrack. No one's talked about whether or not any of this is internationally illegal except you. You said one thing about that here. Are we in a realm now of just pure, real politics, practical policy, where international law norms and the global order just don't matter anymore?
One reason unification of Syria is so important is that under a united government, only the foreign forces invited by the government are allowed in the country. The U.S. forces in Afghanistan and the U.S. forces in Saudi Arabia and the U.S. forces in Iraq are there legally because they have been invited by the governments of those countries. Our troops in Syria are not there legally. They have no authority, either from the United States or any international authority. So the idea that we would rampage in and seize the oil of another country violates the basic principle of the UN, which is what they call the inadmissibility of the acquisition of territory by force.
Okay, 30 seconds. What is the single thing that you think people should be looking for or paying attention to most?
Let's try to promote projects that unify Syria. And if the Kurds want to unify with the central government of Syria and anyone else wants to do that, that's good for promoting an end to the war and the prospect of a secular Syria making political progress over the next generation.
Stephen Kinzer, Senior Fellow in International and Public Affairs at Brown University's Wanson Institute, also author of the book Poisoner in Chief, Sidney Gottlieb and the CIA Search for Mind Control. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Dearing. This is Radio Boston.